BBC hadn't worked out precisely what to do with local radio. 63% reach, you couldn't help but make money from it. I was miffed because it was taking away from me part of my little empire.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. Stuart Linnell.
Growing up in Birmingham, where I was born and very sick as a baby, actually, which I'm constantly reminded of at the family gatherings these days, that I was lucky to survive, but I did. Taken, dressed in beautiful white, to my grandmother's down the road, where she had, at the bottom of the garden, a railway line. In those days, your houses were heated by coal, whether you liked it or not, and there was a coal pile at the bottom of the garden, so there I am in beautiful white, going back up in the completely opposite colour by the time I'd finished playing down the bottom of the garden, to everybody's distress. And I remember Mr. Dutton's house next door, because he had in the front hall a grandfather clock, and I was just fascinated by the clouds and the moon across the top of the face of the clock. And at the age of four, I was apparently telling the time quite accurately, which you later go on the radio and you find a quite useful skill to have adopted, really. School was interesting in that I went to a school that was called Kingsheath High School for boys, preparatory school for girls. What the difference is, I've never worked out to this day. My father bought me a crystal set and put a huge long aerial down the garden onto the apple tree yards and yards and yards away. And at home, on the mantelpiece in the dining room, as many people I'm sure will say from that era, we had a Bakelite radio. Everybody had a Bakelite radio. Remember, it was cream, and you mess with it at your peril because it was always locked on to the light programme, particularly for Sunday lunchtime, listening to the Navy Lark or Round the Horn or the Billy Cotton Band Show. Radio Luxembourg, hugely Radio Luxembourg, listening to some of the all-time great DJs of the day, and they were disc jockeys then.
And there we heard Fleetwood Mac and Oh Well Part 1, which is, of course, on the Reprise label and is, of course, a Radio Luxembourg Sound Survey recording. Well, that sort of winds us all up for this Wednesday evening.
Pete Murray, I thought, was superb. Just a grand old gentleman, as he's become, but a superstar then of radio, and you heard the likes of Keith Fordyce. And the name that we can't mention these days, but we have to because he's part of radio history, Jimmy Savile, with the Teen and 20 Disc Club, sponsored by Decca Records, and the jingle DECCA that was played out.
You know the Decca signature, DECCA, and you know the Decca catalogue.
I always thought that was interesting, listening to that. Even in those days, it just occurred to me, well, OK, he's playing today's hits, but they're all inevitably Decca records. What about the rest? I went to BHBN, which is the Birmingham Hospital Broadcasting Network, before BBC Local Radio started. I went along there and taken under the wing of a lovely man called David Wigley, who was the head of sport. And we used to do a lot of cricket commentaries because the studios were at Edgbaston, the County Cricket Ground. And we covered football as well. And a Friday night was a night when we invited in lots of guests. And of course, David had his, because he'd been doing it for a while, had his contacts. And being at a cricket ground, we got the likes of Brian Johnston in. And Freddie Truman would come in. And all these big cricket names. What I was also doing at that time, working for the welfare department, working for Birmingham City Council, you got the opportunity to go to Birmingham Town Hall and be paid to watch the concerts, because I could go and be a steward showing you to your seat. But I then got to see the shows, and I saw some amazing stuff. I saw the Osmonds. I saw David Bowie do the Ziggy Stardust show four times, because it was two nights, two shows each night. But later, working for BHBN and doing that at the same time, I was able then to go in with a Ewer, a tape recorder, and interview the likes of Neil Sedaka, Elton John, people like that. And when BBC Local Radio started, BBC Radio Birmingham as it was, I was able to take some of the stuff I was doing for BHBN and use it for them, but also offer it to BBC Radio Birmingham.
Neil Sedaka, top rock idol of the late 50s and early 60s, and now firmly established again as one of America's top singer-songwriters. But it was very nearly Neil Sedaka, concert pianist.
I started as a concert pianist.
It was part-time freelance, really, largely sport. Roger Moody was the sports editor in those days, and very encouraging. And, of course, BBC Local Radio, with no resource at all, somebody tell me it's the same today? Not really. But it certainly was back then, no resource whatsoever. So the fact that I was available, keen and enthusiastic, he sent me out to cover Warsaw or West Bromwich Albion or whoever. Jim Rosenthal making his broadcasting start in those days as well. Mixing with some incredible people, Les Ross in his early days on The Breakfast Show. And Les Ross, of course, taught me a lot just by listening to him. And I was always amazed by the fact that they had no access to play, well, to Needle Time, to play commercially available music. But he had all this library music, and he found some library music, stuff that he could play that was non-copyright versions somehow of current hits. I remember one version of Tears of a Clown that he played. Where he got that from, and it was an instrumental version, I don't know, but he found it on a library disc and was able to play it. But Les was a genius, is a genius, at doing what he did.
Do you like that one, Sarah? You like that one? Were you singing along to that one?
No.
No? Oh, well, you don't like it that much then, do you?
One of my great memories of Radio Birmingham was in those days, or just prior to BBC Local Radio, we had the Light Programme, which became Radio 2.
The BBC Light Programme.
And we had the Home Service, which became Radio 4. The Regional Home Service.
The BBC Home Service.
And the BBC man in the Midlands was a lovely character called Barney Bamford, who was just a legend in his own lunchtime, which usually involved drink. He presented the Saturday afternoon sports show on Radio Birmingham as well. So 2 o'clock he'd be in there, and in front of him on the desk would be a bottle of brandy. By 5 o'clock, when we used to opt into Sports Report on Radio 2 then, the bottle of brandy was empty. Barney had drunk this during the course of the programme. Still steady on his feet, still perfectly articulate. And then he would make his way up to the floor above at Pebble Mill, where we were broadcasting from, to the Midlands Club, the BBC Midlands Club. And he then went from his bottle of brandy, which he'd drunk during the programme, to a Guinness. And this one particular Saturday, he'd just finished his first Guinness, having consumed the bottle of brandy, and he'd just been bought another one when a message came up from downstairs. They're calling you from London, Barney. Few expletives from Barney Bamford about being distracted from his evening drink, but he was on duty, apparently, on call. And there'd been a horrible murder at Worcester. The M5 in those days was two lanes either side. It wasn't a three-lane motorway either side. So he had to get on that motorway and drive down from Birmingham to Worcester, having consumed a bottle of brandy and a Guinness, with another Guinness waiting for him when he got back. Halfway down the road to Worcester, he was stopped by a police car coming alongside him in the offside lane. Pulled him over onto the hard shoulder and asked him who he was and what he was doing. He apparently got out of his car, he told us with great aplomb afterwards, on the basis that if you walk towards them and you can do it in a straight line, they can't touch you, whatever your breath smells like. That was his theory. He explained to them he was from Her Majesty's Broadcasting Corporation on a serious mission to report a murder. They escorted him there, escorted him back, and nothing more was said about it. Those were the sort of days we lived in back then.
First, your local headlines. Wally's chief dental officer is definitely going to stand for election to Birmingham City Council.
When Radio Birmingham launched, we were on FM mono. No audience. One man and maybe a dog somewhere had an FM radio. And they gave us a medium wave frequency to give us an audience eventually.
Good morning, everybody. This is BBC Radio Birmingham, your local radio station, broadcasting on 95.6 VHF.
I got to a point where I was doing more and more on air, the occasional show. Very occasional, but I did get the chance to do some. Having met, by the way, I should mention him, somebody who taught me an awful lot about interviewing, a lovely man called Stan Smith, great doyen of the newsroom at Birmingham. And he took me to one side one day and he said, if you want to interview anybody, just remember one thing. You only ever need to ask one question. Mr. Bloggs, what's it all about? That's all you ever need to say, because then if you're using the most important bits of kit you've got, which are your ears, you then respond and you have a conversation and you've got your interview. And I'll never forget that, and that lasted with me for, well, forever, really.
It's 6 o'clock. Good morning. This is Brian Shepherd with BRMB Sound News. A strike by building workers has stopped working...
The time came when commercial radio was beginning to emerge, and BRMB, just across the city, was making a big noise. And I'd applied for a job there as sports editor of BRMB. And David Pennell was the chief executive, and apparently I got on a shortlist of two, the other being Tony Butler, who got the job, and quite rightly too, because Tony's a superstar and a great man, and he made that job his own in a way I never could have done. And another friend of mine who'd worked for Radio Birmingham, but had gone on to the new London station LBC, Ian Rufus, got in touch with me to say, I'm going to Sheffield to launch this new station, Radio Hallam, and I need a sports editor. Would you be interested in going for that? That's what I did. Hallam was full of character. It was launched, remember, as Edward Heath had introduced the three-day week. So not a great time to launch any business. It was phenomenal. As with many of the so-called heritage commercial stations, when it went on the air, it attracted a huge audience, largely because there was no commercial competition. There was local competition there, because BBC Radio Sheffield were already on the air and very successful and a very good station.
In South Yorkshire and the North Midlands, sport is big, and here on Radio Hallam, we treat it in a big way. Every Saturday throughout the soccer season, our outside broadcast teams will be watching and reporting on the matches involving...
But we just had an extraordinary lineup of people, really. Bill McDonald was a singular, unique character with bags of experience in North America, Bill. A lovely, lovely man. And his wife, who was also part of the team, really. He quite sensibly made contact with our dear friend, the lovely cardboard shoes, Keith Skews, from the BBC, because he knew that Skewsy knew everybody and would be able to put a great team together. Well, he not only knew everybody, he knew everybody that had been sacked by the BBC and therefore all had a point to prove. First of all, he employed somebody who hadn't actually been sacked but had fallen out with the BBC because he didn't feel they'd looked after him very well. That was Johnny Moran, who'd been on Radio 1 and he'd presented Seen and Heard on a Friday night, which was reviewing records and looking at all the stuff that was coming out new. But Johnny wanted to do a lot more than that. And he got the breakfast show on Hallam. A lovely, cultured voice Johnny had in those days, well, still does. It was a great hit at breakfast time.
A very good morning. Radio Hallam is on the air. It's 6 a.m. and from this moment, we're commencing broadcasting programmes on frequencies of 194 metres medium wave.
And he employed people like Bill Crozier from Two-Way Family Favourites, the other end of Gene Metcalf, as he constantly reminded us. And he employed one or two local people, Ray Stewart from Radio Sheffield, and then the character, when you asked me how I would sum up Sheffield, I nearly said these two words to sum it up: Roger Moffat. If ever there was a voice to die for, it was Roger Moffat.
Well, there we end broadcasting in the Light Programme, not just for today, but... as it seems, forever. The Light Programme, that is, as it's known.
He'd been
now,
the doyen of the Light Programme and then Radio 2. Sacked by the BBC, I believe I'm right in saying, three times. And Roger related some distance, but nonetheless a cousin of the Queen Mother. As we found out, every time he had a birthday, there was the card from Her Royal Highness. Oh, Her Majesty, I should say. Roger was just brilliant. Very, very funny, very clever.
On Radio Hallam, you'll get the news fast. Whether it's a new government in Romania or a new council in Rotherham, you'll hear about it first on Radio Hallam.
Ian Rufus was the news editor, and he'd come up with the notion of doing news at 5 to the hour. So Radio Hallam's news was 5 minutes sooner. Or, as Radio Sheffield reminded us, 5 minutes later. So the news was at 5 to 10, Roger going on the air at 9. And we got to 20 minutes to 10 o'clock, and suddenly, working in the newsroom, I was suddenly aware of people running around the place, absolute pandemonium. People tearing down the corridors to the studio, because we'd now gone for 40 minutes of Roger Moffat's programme and we'd not played a single commercial yet. And we were allowed 9 minutes an hour in those days. So we had been 20 to 10 to 5 to 10 to get 9 minutes of commercials away. Roger had completely forgotten that he was supposed to play any advertisements on this brand new commercial radio station. So that was Roger. Who started every show with an overture to a musical, South Pacific, West Side Story, My Fair Lady. And whenever you asked him why, his answer was, well, if I don't, who will? You just can't answer that, can you? Keith Skew's reason for putting Roger on at that time of day was because he'd be sure that Roger would turn up in a reasonable state of sobriety, because once the pubs opened, you could just say goodbye to Roger. He used to go into the pub, the Dove and Rainbow, next door. The first drink he would have would be a barley wine. Then you would offer to buy him a drink, because it's your round, and he would have a scotch. He would then have, buy one himself, a barley wine, scotch, barley wine. And it'd be like following a radio dial, a meter. All of us, it would be peaking maximum, be really funny, and all of a sudden, wham, it'd gone. And that was how Roger was. Andy Fairweather Lowe came to be interviewed by Skews and Roger together one day, just after he left Amen Corner, And allegedly, he went for a session with Roger and Keith Skews, and off the back of that, he wrote Wide-Eyed and Legless.
So, on behalf of all of us here at Radio Hallam in Sheffield, may we wish you all a very good night.
Wherever I go.
Good night, everybody.
And whatever I do.
I was doing sport. We had six football clubs, Sheffield Wednesday, United, Rotherham, Chesterfield, Barnsley, Doncaster. We had the Yorkshire and Derbyshire cricket, lots more besides Speedway. But I did more than that. I did the sports show on a Saturday, but I also did stand-in shows for other people, late-night shows occasionally, weekend shows from time to time. My aunt and uncle lived there, so I was able to live with them to start with. And I spent six very, very happy years in Sheffield. Lovely place.
And tonight, while Sheffield United entertain their World Cup guests from Argentina, Sheffield Wednesday make their bid for League Cup honours.
My Hallam spell ended when Ian Rufus moved on, and we sort of followed each other like ships in the night in many ways. Ian came to Coventry to be the first programme controller, having been elevated now from being news editor at Hallam, programme controller in Coventry, and he phoned me up and he said, would you like to come and do the same thing here, be sports editor at Mercia? Oh, and by the way, do you fancy doing a daily show as well? Because we've only got one football team, so you won't be anywhere near as busy as you were at Sheffield. Ian's appreciation of what went into being a sports editor was not great. The original deal was that I would do the afternoon show, Afternoon Delight we called it, using that song as the theme tune. Again, a team of great characters which Ian built, not with the same backgrounds as those that Skews had put together in Sheffield, but nonetheless a really strong team. And not only did we have no local commercial competition, there was BRMB from Birmingham, but again, the signal wasn't great everywhere in Coventry and people wanted their own thing. But there was no BBC competition here at the time. There should have been, but the BBC, for whatever reason, dragged its feet over going to Coventry. So for 10 years, actually, Mercia Sound, as it was called, the station had its own way. And for any BBC or local programmer these days, looking at their radar figures and thinking that they're doing well with 20%, which they probably are, 63% reach in those days, in the early days of Mercia. I mean, which is something you'll never ever see again. Just extraordinary. And that was a measure of, a real measure of how the population here took to us.
This is Mercia Sound on 220 metres medium wave, 1359 kilohertz, and 95.9 VHF in stereo.
But I just remember it being a pretty smooth launch, actually.
Good morning.
In Coventry. It went very, very well. I mean, we'll always remember Gordon Astley, our first breakfast show presenter. Gordon drives away your boredom and all of that with his jingles. And he really was the right man to really make his mark and make the station smart.
Yes, I'm sitting in the presentation chair this morning, so I might as well do the programme. Good morning, listeners, shareholders.
Then we had Dave Jameson following that in mid-morning. And Dave actually had been one of my great heroes in Birmingham broadcasting because he'd been on BRMB and he used to do the chart show on a Sunday afternoon there. And I used to love listening to him there. To work with him was quite something. But then I did the afternoon show. Tony Gillam did the drive time show. I think he's still trying to earn an honest penny somewhere in the world. I'd say went on the air with tremendous success. Really picked up an audience that was desperate for what we were there to do, which would deliver their stories, their voices, music they wanted to hear.
Stuart Linnell.
At Hallam, it was a question of trying to almost reinvent the Light programme, but without the BBC bureaucracy is probably the one I'm looking for. By the time we got to Mercia, that sort of thing was no longer a concern, really, because commercial radio, albeit not everybody had it in their area, but they were aware of it. They were aware of what it did. And the other thing, significant thing, that it may not sound a terribly grand thing to have done, but it was typical of what commercial radio had done by then, was to introduce the soundbite into a news bulletin. Because before LBC and Capital in London, before Hallam in Sheffield and the other stations in that first wave, the BBC News had been a news bulletin that was read. There was no illustration in the news, very, very rarely. But suddenly, along comes this brash commercial radio notion of, if you're going to say that the Prime Minister said so-and-so, well, let's hear his voice or her voice. It was significant and typical of what people then began to expect commercial radio to be. So I think it was that sort of feel that there was an immediacy to it, there was an intimacy to it that maybe you weren't getting from national broadcasters, perhaps.
Hello, Coventry.
from Mercia Sound.
It was doing extraordinarily well, and I think we were all buoyed up by that, but 63% reach, you couldn't help but make money from it, which is what it was all about, really. What we also had at Mercia was, which I'd not been aware of at Hallam in the same way, was quite an extraordinary lineup of characters in our boardroom. The chairman was Jack Butterworth, who was the founder vice-chancellor of the University of Warwick. He later became Lord Butterworth, and he was a larger-than-life character, and he surrounded himself with people like that. And we were very aware of them. Geoffrey Robinson, local MP, for many, many years standing, the former paymaster general, who famously got into the news by providing Peter Mandelson with a mortgage and so on and so forth, and indeed a villa in Tuscany for Tony Blair to go on holiday. He was part of the board, and big characters. The Peter Mandelson thing, I was interviewing him, actually, at Radio Birmingham in my second stint there, because I went back to Pebble Mill later. And it was a time when Tony Blair was the Prime Minister, and there was a big, big fuss in the newspapers that Tony Blair had gone on holiday to Tuscany. He'd gone to Geoffrey Robinson's villa. And Peter Mandelson I was on the show talking about something else, and I just said, before you go, is it appropriate for a Labour Prime Minister to go on holiday to a millionaire's villa in Tuscany? And I'd just been made MBE at the time, and Peter Mandelson said, Stuart, you've just been honoured by Her Majesty as a result of the Prime Minister's intervention. I think that question is really beneath you. And sadly, that was the end of the show, and I didn't have too much time to challenge him. But so we had all sorts of characters around us in the boardroom as well as on the station, which I think that made you aware of the commercial nature of the game. Ian Rufus had left us to go to Viking Radio. John Bradford was our managing director. And then it was announced that John was leaving. And Ian came back to Mercia to be managing director of the radio station. Before that happened, I'd become programme controller on Ian's departure to Viking. John Bradford invited Dave Jameson and I to go to have a meal with him. And we went to one of our favourite Italian restaurants in Coventry to enjoy that. And we had a long conversation about radio and what we would do. And I think we were both, Dave and I were both conscious that we were being weirdly interviewed at the same time, simultaneously. I think I went away thinking, well, it'll be Dave, because he's been in the business longer than me, actually, in commercial radio, certainly, and I would always be perfectly happy to work for him. And out of the blue, he gave it to me. I'm sure Dave was upset by that. I would have been if it had been him. Anyway, that's what happened. I became programme controller and found myself with this new role of trying to lead the team, as well as do some on-air stuff. I was determined I wasn't going to give that up, even if it meant only doing one show a week. And then Ian came back and became managing director. And then David Pinnell, the managing director of BRMB, retired. And I was invited to apply for that, which by their chairman, who I'd got to know quite well. And so I went along for interview. And I thought, well, I should really tell Ian that I've gone for this, because it would be unfair. He's going to find out. So I went to see Ian and I said, I've been interviewed for the job at BRMB. Oh, right, OK, thanks for letting me know. And we had a very convivial chat. And I didn't know, of course, at that time that he'd been invited for interview as well. And he got the job at BRMB. Again, I was pleased for him. So Mercia was then left without a managing director. Lord Butterworth called me into a meeting with him. He came, drove up in his Jaguar, parked in my car parking spot, which he often did. Said, I want to see you, my boy. Come and sit with me. So I sat with him. So Ian's got this job in Birmingham, has he? Said Jack like that, not very impressed. So I said, yeah. So he said, well, look, we've had a chat. We think we should offer you the job. So I said, oh, well, that's extremely kind. You're not going to have an interview, advertise it and have an interview process. He said, no, I don't think we need to do that. He said, but having said that, that's not a bad idea. Maybe you should come down and see me at the Heiss. And I thought, well, which Heiss does he mean? His Heiss in Gloucestershire, his Heiss in Coventry, or the Heiss of Lords? And he meant the House of Lords. So I went for tea with him at the House of Lords in the Peers dining room. And I was just sat there open-mouthed as the Archbishop of Canterbury went past here and Lord somebody else went past down there. But off the back of that, he gave me the job and we got on famously. Then I thought I was extraordinarily sophisticated way back in the day. I thought I knew all the answers, as a brave young fool does. And clearly I didn't. But I suppose I followed a fairly conventional route, a fairly conventional attitude to the way things should be. but I always looked for that little bit of something. I'm trying to think of the name of the guy at the IBA back in the day, and I can't remember his name now. Paul Brown said to me, the trick in good programming is having the element of surprise. Every now and again, just have that little bit something different that they're not expecting, to keep them listening, to keep them going, oh, really? In their attitude towards what you're doing. And I've always tried to keep that in my mind. And also to encourage new talent, if possible. In those days, we used to get tapes coming through the post, cassette tapes. But I did, as much as I could, I used to listen to most of them. And you could usually tell within the first 30 seconds, maybe if they're really good, a minute, minute and a half, whether there was something worth listening to, whether you wanted to go on. The nature of the voice, the intensity, the creativity, was there something different? Was there that element of surprise? And Bernie Keith in particular is the one that really stands out. Lovely Bernie has regularly told people, bless him, that I gave him, he used the words, everything he's got is down to me, which I think is overstating it hugely, because he's done it, not me. But yes, I gave him his start. And I remember listening to that tape, thinking there's something there. I'm not quite sure what it is, but there's something there I would like to hear more of. Let's get him up to talk to, see if he'll come to us. And he lived in Plimpton in Devon. And I thought, if he's prepared to make the journey to Coventry, then he clearly is interested. So I ended up doing the interview with Bernie, and he came in to see me, this tiny character in a smart suit. He was an accountant and looked a bit like an accountant, if I'm honest. And he had these huge Dennis Taylor snooker type glasses on, almost upside down glasses. And he was very nervous, but also you could see within the nerves sort of a steely determination that this is what I want to do. That was enough for me. So he eventually got The Late Show, which is the place you started in those days. And he was outrageous from the start. And again, there were many a time I had to have quiet conversations with him about things he'd said, things he was doing. But he became a huge, huge success, and is now a huge success on BBC Radio Northampton.
Happiness today, what makes us happy? This woman studies happiness, and in February she launched the Little Happiness Ingredients Project to find out what it is that we need to give us happiness.
Along the way, I don't know whether he's ever really forgiven me, but the day when BBC CWR, as it was called, BBC Coventry Warwickshire was called, launched, I thought, right, we've got to do something about this. And in the back of my mind, I had this memory of the day ITV launched and the BBC deny it to this day. They did it as a spoiler, but they had the fire on the archers and Grace Archer was killed. So I thought, well, we can't burn Mercia down and have the presenter killed, but what can we do? Now, at that time, commercial radio was in the throes of launching the Network Chart Show presented by David Kidd Jensen. Our challenge to Radio 1's Top 40.
Hi there, it's David Kidd Jensen here with the very first Network Chart Show coming at you right across the nation on independent radio. Now, every Sunday afternoon from 5 till
and
7...
And I know a lot of my colleagues around the country were very, very anti this. Thought this is an alien being sitting in the midst of our Sunday afternoon programming. It's not right. My attitude was, look, yeah, OK, I'd rather we were doing our own thing, but it's there, it brings some money to us. It's a high-profile presenter. It's going to be a well-produced programme. Let's be positive and use it well. And I knew David Jensen, as it happens. And I phoned him up and I said, would you do something for me? Would you come up and be interviewed on our breakfast show, which Bernie Keith was presenting by now, and just promote your show? I said, but there's a bit of a twist to it. And he duly came up. He did his show on Capital Radio, Drive Time Show, that afternoon. Came up from London, we booked him into a hotel in Coventry, and he duly turned up on the breakfast show. Bernie really, really excited at interviewing David Jensen on his programme. And they're into the interview, a couple of minutes maybe, when the studio door opens, and in walks another old friend of mine, Sergeant Bob Esselmont, head of police in Coventry from the police station with two officers. Live on air, are you Bernie Keith? Yes, we're taking you away. We have reason to believe we need to interview you at the police station. What? Goes Bernie, not knowing what the heck to do. Kidd Jensen fully briefed as to what was going to happen. said, Bernie, he sort of blustered through, I'm not sure quite what's going on, Bernie, but look, do you go and sort this out, I'll take over the show. So for the rest of the breakfast show, we had our breakfast show presented by David Kidd Jensen, big, big national DJ. And what David Jensen then said when Bernie was out of the studio and away to the police cells, David Jensen said, and of course, what Bernie doesn't know is this is all to raise money for our Christmas charity, Charity Snowball. If you want Bernie released, pledge now. So, and we did that, and we made a decent amount of money. Bernie had it all explained to him when he got to the police station. Very, very angry Bernie confronted me later. Why didn't you tell me? I said, well, it wouldn't have been quite the same, Bernie, if I had. But we made a lot of money, and it was the day BBC Coventry and Warwickshire launched, BBC CWR launched, we got the front page of the Coventry Telegraph, needless to say.
Now, a lot of people have been advising us on what our first record should be on BBC CWR. Thank you for all your suggestions. In the end, we've picked this one. The lyrics just about say it all.
On our board at the time, we had the chairman at that time, he's no longer with us, a guy called Phil White, chairman of the Coventry Building Society.
We've only just begun.
Phil was very much the self-made multi-millionaire. I had a scrap metal. I used to go to his office at a scrapyard in Hinckley, totally unprepossessing. You wouldn't imagine that it was run by somebody with his degree of wealth. It was a prefabricated building. And I went to see him from time to time there. And this one Christmas I'd been to see him. And as I walked into his office, he'd got the carpet rolled back and there was a safe in the floor. And he was putting, I mean, who knows how much money, but bankrolls of cash into this safe in the floor. You didn't see that, he said. You did not see that. I said, no, of course you did. In his office, there were televisions, about three or four of them on their side piled up, that he'd burnt the screens out because he had it constantly on, showing the gilts as they were changing. And then he'd be on the phone to his brokers, moving his money around all day long. And that's the sort of guy he was. He was driven to make money. And he was advised, in much of what he did, by Barings, the famous bank that, as we all know, bit the dust later. So they became our advisors in the deal with BRMB. It was largely driven by, as many things have been since, really, in commercial radio, it seems to me, driven by the need to make sense of national advertising. Because at Mercia, we got this massive reach of 63%. OK, inevitably, with competition coming on and the BBC coming into town, it dropped away to 40%, still a figure that stations now would dream of. But despite that, and despite the fact that we were doing well with local advertisers as a consequence, but we weren't making what we felt we should be, not just us, but other stations. I know I had a conversation with Ron Coles at Trent about the same thing, Radio Trent and Leicester and stations elsewhere across the country. We weren't getting our fair share of national advertising revenue, the amount of money we should have been in return for the audience we were delivering. We invited at one point to the Mercia boardroom for a meal with us to try and understand this. UK senior management from Mars, biggest advertiser in the country by a mile. And we were getting pennies from them by comparison with what we felt we should be getting and what other media was getting. He said to me, well, we're not advertising with you because you're not delivering the audience we want. So I said, well, what do you mean we're not delivering the audience you want? 60%, 40% of the local population. He said, yeah, but your population, it's slightly different now, but then it was very, very geared to a 40-plus, 50-plus age group in the city of Coventry. He said they've made their branding decisions. They already know they want to buy Mars or they don't want to buy Mars or they want to buy this soap powder or that soap powder. What we're about in national advertising these days is trying to get people to decide what brand they will follow. He said, with the best will in the world, you're not going to do that by yourself, sitting there on your own, little Mercia. And clearly, to a different scale, because as a city more than three times the size, that was happening in Birmingham too. So that was the logic behind putting the two stations together, and later other station groups, of course, combined as well. So we did the deal. So Lord Butterworth and I were invited to the boardroom at Barings in the City of London, looking over the city in this magnificent building. Beautiful, beautiful lunch in a magnificent boardroom. And Jack had a thing, Jack Butterworth, where he would, at the drop of a hat, fall asleep. This used to happen when he used to come to meet me for briefings before board meetings. Very off-putting, when you're in the middle of explaining to him why you were going to make some changes or whatever you're going to do, and you'd realise he'd gone to sleep. And I said to Ian, how did you cope with that? He said, well, I just shut up until he woke up again. I thought, well, I'm not very comfortable doing that. So I just spoke and spoke, and he'd just carry on talking slightly louder. And he would eventually wake up and go, oh, yes, as if he'd been following the conversation along. So there we are in Barings, and he nodded off. And the chairman of Barings said, looked at me, and I sort of grimaced back at him and shrugged my shoulders. And eventually Jack comes round with an, oh, yes, as if he'd been part of the conversation all along. And the chairman of Barings said, it must be very tiring in the House of Lords. No. Why would you think that? Says Jack, completely now conscious and with us back in the world. But yeah, so that was a fascinating time. And of course, the deal goes through and we join forces with BR&B. BR&B Music Hour. Ian and I had known each other very well for a long, long time. And so I had no problems about working with him. And particularly because he said, you know, you run Coventry, the programming decisions, as long as they're not a million miles away from where we're going as a combined unit. But I did feel as though I wasn't really quite part of it. One of the crunch things that happened that made me dissatisfied, if you like, about what was going on was when we split the frequencies for the first time. Bearing in mind, when I say split frequencies, we were on FM and we were on AM, on medium wave. FM and AM needed to be split apart from a footballing point of view so that we weren't taking off your favourite evening music programme every time we did a football commentary on a Tuesday night or a Wednesday night. And there were clearly other reasons besides, because suddenly you could have two radio stations where you only had one, twice the advertising minutage, potentially not twice the revenue, but more revenue. The first experimentation of that we had done at Mercia. We had created an evening schedule for medium wave, whereby we had, I forget precisely which night of the week it was, but we had an Irish programme on one night, we had programme for the Asian community, programmes for the Polish community, which is quite significant in Coventry. And it worked very well. And of course, we could do football programmes. But then it was decided that experiment had worked well, and therefore stations across the board could split 24 hours a day. And a lovely guy who I get on very well with, and lives not far away from me these days, Phil Riley, working at BRMB. Phil had been a DJ at BRMB, had taken himself off to America to get a very, very good degree, and had come back armed with a lot of great ideas as a businessman, clear focus about where commercial radio should be going. And with the benefit of hindsight, you have to say Ian made exactly the right decision by giving Phil the job of launching what was then called Extra AM, the new frequency that split away from BRMB and Mercia, and did its own thing. And intelligently, they took Les Ross, who would be fitting the audience they wanted to target, which was play oldies music, Beach Boys, Cliff Richard, Elvis Presley. They took Les Ross and put him on the breakfast show on X-Ray. I mean, it was a great, great success.
It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 4th of April, 1989. I'm Les Ross. Welcome to XTRA Extra AM. Now, that's the cue for the champagne.
I was miffed, though, when that happened, because it was taking away from me, from my direct control, part of my little empire. I understood it. I sulked, rather, if I'm honest. And with the benefit of hindsight, as I say, it was exactly the right decision. But then I wasn't quite so enamoured with it. But round the corner, I was aware that other things were about to happen. And that could have made... It didn't, as it turns out, but it could have made life very, very different. And some of those things were first a merger with Piccadilly Radio in Manchester. The idea would be that the big cities of Manchester and Birmingham would come together with Mercia as part of the deal, obviously because we were then one company with BRMB. And so we went through quite a lengthy process of working out what we would do. Colin Walters was the legendary managing director of Piccadilly Radio. Great team, very exciting team, which was, of course, to spawn Chris Evans and others, creatively brilliant. And Tom Tyrrell was their sports editor. I remember getting on very well with Tom, big Manchester United man. And we went through this process of trying to put the two companies together. But we were spiked by a man called Owen Oyston, who had great pretensions in his life to be a Shakespearean actor, and that's the way he presented himself wherever you met him. Tall man, flowing hair, a long goatee beard, and always the black coat and the black fedora hat. And he made a bid to buy Piccadilly. He was running Red Rose Radio at the time in Preston. He made a bid to buy Piccadilly Radio. Our chairman, their chairman, Piccadilly's chairman, that is, Ian, myself, Colin Walters, and their executive team, we met frequently to make sure our deal was on course. But the Piccadilly chairman had to, of course, pay due regard to Owen Royston, who was a shareholder. He was perfectly entitled to make his bid. And it got to a meeting in Manchester. The meeting was about to start, and there was no sign of Owen Royston. And had he not turned up, our deal would have gone through. He was not there to vote against it. Literally, and I mean literally, 30 seconds before the appointed time, the double doors were flung open, and in comes this character. The cape is whipped off and dropped to a seat nearby. The fedora is put on the floor. "I am so sorry to be late, Chairman, but I think, actually, I'm just in time." And he won the day, or at least he saw us off. And so our deal didn't happen. And we know that he went on later to other things, shall we say, Blackpool Football Club and besides.
The update at 2 o'clock. I'm Joanna Hartley. It seems likely that Lancashire millionaire Owen Oyston's won his £39 million takeover bid for the Piccadilly Radio Group. His Miss World group seems certain to take over.
So we came back with our tail between our legs a little bit, very disappointed. The idea would have been that I would have gone to Manchester. Ian would have run Birmingham and I would have run Manchester, and I'd have been very, very happy with that, thank you very much. But it didn't happen. So we came back, and at that point we started to talk to Ron Coles at Nottingham. Ron, of course, had Nottingham, Leicester and Derby under his purview. And putting the East Midlands and the West Midlands together seemed to make a lot of sense. And so that's what we did. Not without a bit of frustration along the way, it has to be said, in terms of doing the deal, but it was that they were business details, really. In terms of the creative side, and which I was more interested in, and the programming side, we could see how all that could fit together. And for a time, I was left in charge of Mercy, but also put in charge of Leicester, which, again, was a really exciting thing for me. I was up and down the M69 like a who knows what. In the course of all of this, Capital Radio emerges as a player that's clearly wanting to try to make sense of the industry. A lot of people were trying to make sense of commercial radio without necessarily properly explaining why or what they were about. But Capital Radio comes into the picture as well. Ralph Bernhard, by this time, had gone to Wiltshire, where he'd formed GWR, Great Western Radio, if you like. I knew very well from Hallam days because Ralph had been a news reporter. A news reporter who hated being a news reporter. He wanted to be something more than that. He wanted to be a documentary maker or whatever. And he did make a stunningly successful documentary series, Dying for a Drink, about alcoholism. And he came to me and said, "I need a narrator for this. I need somebody to tell the story." He said, "You know Michael Parkinson, don't you?" Well, I did vaguely, because Parky lived, obviously came from Yorkshire and still had family in Barnsley. He got a big, big mate of his where he used to come out of London to relax with in Rotherham, a guy who ran a pub. Ralph Bernhard said, "Go and ask Parky if he'll do it for me." So I thought, well, anyway, so mate and I went out to this pub in Rotherham, and there was Michael Parkinson with friends propping up the bar. Now, what I didn't know at the time was that Parky had his moments with drink as well in those days. Not badly, but he did. And he'll tell you honestly about that today, that he had a bit of a problem. I had no idea about this. So there am I, who he didn't know that well, but he knew me enough. And so I went to the bar. I thought, well, it's now or never. And he sort of nods across to me and sort of just about recognises me, nods in my direction. I said, "Michael, good evening. Can I ask you a question?" He says, What do you want to know?" I said, "We're looking for somebody to narrate a programme about alcoholism for the radio." He said, So that didn't happen. That was the end of the conversation. It was very, very brief. And I had to go back and say to Ralph, "He doesn't really want to do it, Ralph." And in the end, Douglas Cameron did.
Having established that alcoholism is a disease which can affect almost any sort of person...
So I knew Ralph from way, way back. And Ralph, by this time, had gone to GWR. And he had also, in a similar way to Phil Riley, Phil had taken himself off to a university in America, to New York, to get his degree. Ralph didn't do that, but he had a chairman at Wiltshire who sat down with him and very patiently guided him through what he needed to know to be a very successful businessman. And GWR takes over this conglomerate in the Midlands. And everybody was wary of them because they'd taken over stations elsewhere. And the stories were not ones that presenters were necessarily happy to hear. And we went through the issues that people elsewhere had gone through, where we were telling people on air every day, almost every hour, if not more than that. This was the new Mercia.
The all-new Mercia FM.
And this went on being the new Mercia for getting on for 2 years, based on advice from programmers from Australia who were looking in on the UK scene at this stage, saying that it'll take that long for the message to really get home, that things have changed. I was resistant to it because I knew what had worked for Mercia. I knew that we'd got that 60% reach when we started, and the 40% reach later diluted to, but maintained that because we'd provided a diet of music and chat that people really got into and was obviously local and worked. And more than that, in Coventry, BBC Local Radio had been very late on the scene, hadn't come in trying to steal our clothes at all. And when they did arrive, trying to do the same as we were doing, they failed dismally at it because we'd already got the audience, we're already doing it. And of course, just at the time that they arrived, all this was going on and we were changing tack and becoming very much music, 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 with very little local chat beyond that. And what was the chat for the presenters was written down for them on so-called liner cards. And a lot of the presenters should have lost faith in the creative process, I think, because of that. And I did to a degree. And of course, that should have handed the BBC local radio station in Coventry the audience, but they'd messed up in a way, despite the anxieties that I'd got, despite the negative feelings that the presenters had towards the new way of doing things from GWR. It worked, and the station continued to be hugely successful.
The all-new Mercia FM At Work Network.
So there we are, following Coventry City as we will in a cup competition, which was a very convoluted effort. So Coventry City have got to the final against Crewe Alexandra, and we'd lost the home leg at the Ricoh Arena by 3-0. So everybody's thinking, gosh, we've got to score goals when we go up there. After the match, we take the phone calls from fans, and then this guy comes on and he says, "That was appalling. I cannot believe we've come all this way, 3-0 down." I said, "Dan, you obviously went before the end."
"I thought we'd at least win 1 or 2-0 and give us something to cheer about.
Dan,
the most disappointing thing for me is the fact that we've just gone there and we didn't even get a goal."
Dan, we won 2-0.
What?
We won 2-0 tonight.
What do you mean we
went
2-0 tonight?
The
final score tonight was Crewe Alexandra 0, Coventry City 2. That was the final score.
I'm not having that. We left 2 minutes before the end of the game. We went 2-0 tonight, apparently, lads. I'm not having that. You haven't won.
I'd been there for 15 years by the time I left. Ralph had said to me, "We want to do things differently. I don't want to lose you. Would you like to go off and explore other things? What did you want to do?" I'd had got this idea in my head that maybe there was a role somewhere in this brave new commercial world for syndicated sports programming. So I tried to create something around that, and I spent, if I'm honest, the best part of 6 months probably sitting at my dining table at home wondering what the hell am I supposed to do now, bearing in mind that a lot of the sports contracts that you needed if you're going to make any success at it were already taken up by the BBC anyway. I wasn't able to open the doors I thought that I would have to make the thing work. And just at that moment, I got a phone call completely out of the blue from somebody else I'd worked with at Hallam, a guy called David Roby, who by this time was assistant managing editor at BBC WM, which is what was BBC Radio Birmingham back in the day. And he said, "I gather you've left Mercy." So I said, "Well, not quite, but more or less." He said, "Because I need somebody to do some fill-ins for me, so would you come and do it?" So I went over and I sat in on a show for a couple of weeks for them in Birmingham at Pebble Mill. And that was that, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. And then a week later, I got a call, would I go and do another one? So I went back and did another week, and I enjoyed that. Meeting up with my old friend Ed Doolin again on the radio station and one or two other people. And also the guy that I stood in for, Malcolm Boyden. And then I got another phone call from Birmingham saying, "We're looking for a breakfast presenter." So I went to do the breakfast show at BBC WM and enjoyed that absolutely thoroughly. It was an all-talk show. It was news-based. Very, very different. One of my other loves along the way, as I've sort of talked about sport and music, has always been politics. From an amateur perspective, I guess, in many ways, early on, always enjoyed following the political forum, the cut and thrust. And here I am now with a chance to actually deal with it, with what's going on. And an area the size of the one covered by BBC WM, there's a lot of politics to cover because you've got lots of towns, Birmingham itself, and much more besides. So, and I'll be perfectly frank with you, I never really got under the skin of a lot of that because there was so much of it. But actually, I made a reasonable fist of it and was able to win a silver Sony in 1996. The following year, we won a gold for the best speech-based breakfast show in company and competition with the Today Show and Radio 4 and people like that. So I was thrilled to bits. Same year, Malcolm Boyden won a gold, and we had a thoroughly great time that year. Very soon after that, the BBC decided it didn't want to employ me anymore. We fell out big time over an issue which I think they were wrong, and I think in this day and age they would admit they were wrong. I had had a letter sent in to a colleague in Coventry that was passed on to me, inviting me to do some media training for this particular company. Would I do it? And my reply back was very, very vague, very, very bland, simply saying, tell me more and I'll see what I can do. Not saying that I would do it at all, but saying, if necessary, I'll pass you on. Anyway, I'm then called into the senior management's office at WM, presented with a photocopy of this letter, and they said that was proof positive that I was doing media training without permission and so on and so forth. It was a very unpleasant meeting. And no matter what I said, they weren't going to listen to me. And just to make it worse, as I'm leaving the building on security, they said, will you give us your pass? Blah, blah, blah. And that was it. They didn't want to see me again. I was gone that day. And I felt very upset about that. And I came home and I spoke to my wife and I said, I'm not quite sure what I should do about this, whether to take it on, challenge them legally. And in a way I wish I had, but I didn't at the time, because they had said I'd have a payoff, and I felt financially I'm not sure I can afford to go through the motions legally with all of this. I'm sure I'd have won had I done it. So I was without a job, but had some money in my pocket, so I thought, well, I'll swallow my pride and see what else I can do. So I went and did some freelance work for Sky TV, Sky Sports, and for the short-lived Satanta from Ireland. But the guys who produced Satanta, which, as we know, went out of business, were also involved, as it turns out, with an Irish commercial radio station called Today FM. And they gave me some football work most weekends, which kept me going very nicely. So, in the wilderness for a while, and looking for a chance to get back into radio, as I say, and along comes an opportunity to go and work with somebody I'd known vaguely, a guy called Nigel Reeve, from very, very good salesman. And he had the dream and the idea of forming a commercial radio company running small-scale local stations. And it had everything going for it, except money. It didn't really have any financial backing. And sadly, in many ways, out of misplaced loyalty to Nigel, I think, with no disrespect to him, I stayed the course with that. And I should have got out of it. It cost me a fair bit of money. The company eventually went into administration, and some very difficult days along the way, where I was, amongst other people, it wasn't just me, but I was actually, rather than being paid by the company myself, actually paying presenters from my own financial resources, which weren't great. So it was difficult. It was a difficult time, and one that I prefer to draw a veil over because it was so unpleasant. But I start to send emails off to people that I know in the BBC in particular, and one or two other places. And I start to get some work from BBC Coventry in Warwickshire, filling in the holiday relief at BBC Radio Derby, some work on sport at BBC Hereford and Worcester, and at BBC Radio Oxford. The problem with it as an organisation is not only, you know, turning the oil tank around, it's an incredibly slow process to turn it around. But also, if you actually say you want to change it, what the heck do you do? Because the minute you say, I'm going to take Six Music off the air, look at the protest. Protests, like, people will not accept it. A lot of it, the protest is built around tradition, inertia maybe, people just getting used to listening to the same thing. But I think something has to change. One thing that I found when I came back to it as a local radio presenter 10 years ago, was that it hadn't worked out, and it still hasn't worked out, precisely what to do with local radio. It really doesn't get it. The Gillard concept was that, and he's the only person, I think, in BBC management that's ever really understood this, is that the news operation which is fundamental in my view to what the BBC does. The news operation and the journalistic effort should be from the ground up, not from the top down. You've got this network of clever journalists right across the country, right around the world. They should be providing the nuts and bolts for you, rather than everything suddenly being top down and coming down and they have to fall in line with what happens from network. It's upside down, really, the way BBC Local Radio is run. And the other thing about BBC Local Radio, which I found disappointingly had not improved, they've never understood what is now called radio. They've never got it, really, how audience measurement works, I don't think. I'm sure there are people there sitting over their laptops who will tell me I don't know what I'm talking about, that they're analysing it upside down, back to front and sideways on. Well, they might be, but they're making the wrong decisions if they are, in my view, for a number of things. I just think there's some things that they do that I don't understand the logic of them, put it like that. Maybe I'm missing the point about it. I think the management of the BBC leaves a lot to be desired. That they've commissioned reports from experienced commercial broadcasters, extraordinarily successful, and they seem to read them, nod their heads wisely, and then put the report on the shelf and it sits there gathering dust. I just don't think it's managed well. I think, and that's the key to it. And I don't think, honestly, that talent across the BBC is valued in the way that it might be. Now the BBC, and it's an old joke, but it's true, the BBC is run by W1A. I know it's a comedy series and all that on television, or has been, but that seems to matter more. Sitting down and nodding wisely and sagely and saying what you hope is the right thing in the conversation, rather than actually looking at the nuts and bolts of what is coming out of the speaker. And then an old friend to whom I'd given his first job way back at Mercia, Bernie Keith, who's at BBC Radio Northampton, was aware of the circumstance. And he said, well, you should come over here because we've got some holiday relief. I'm sure we have. And I'll put a word in for you. And I didn't realise that Bernie was a major, major influence at Northampton at the time, and still is. And he had a word with management, and I was invited in to meet them. And I ended up doing one of his shows for a couple of weeks while he was away. And then again, the lunch show presenter is leaving. Would you like to do this lunchtime consumer show? You can do consumer shows. You've done them before, haven't you? So I said, yeah, well, I sort of have had a bit, but not very much. But I thought, I know exactly what I'll do. I'll just go to the Ed Doolan playbook and follow exactly what he used to do. And so I did the lunch show there for a couple of years. And then they put me on Breakfast, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Did that for 7 years.
BBC Radio Northampton News at 6 o'clock. Andrew Redd.
Good morning. A Northamptonshire man who was infected.
After which, or the end of that 7 years, they said, we'd like to make a change now, which I thoroughly accepted. I'd been doing it for a while, but we'd like you to do afternoon drive. So I did that for 12 months, wandering off into semi-retirement, which means that I'm going back to Northampton again to do a few shows from time to time to fill in for people over there. But at the end of a thoroughly enjoyable 50-odd years.
I wanted to come down because they said to me it's been 50 years. I wanted to come here to tell people about your stellar career, your amazing career.
Here we go.
Because if people have a chance, if they're lucky enough to get into broadcasting, it's quite rare to do the things that you have done. You have reported for radio. You have commentated for radio. You have played music for radio. You have interviewed for radio. You have
very, very
TV.
Emotional for me and for him, I think. And yeah, it was lovely. And he presented me from the present for himself, which is a beautiful bottle of extraordinarily expensive champagne. He's a big fan of champagne, Bernie. And I'd thought in my head, I need to go out on the right track. I need to find the right piece of music to end with. And the Beatles changed everything in my life and the life of many people. So a Beatles track it was, and we played In My Life, which summed up a lot, really.
There are places I remember.
I've always felt it, and this sounds very, very grand, but I've always felt it important to try and give something back if you can. And that was one of the reasons why in Coventry I was very proud of what we did with the charity. We created Snowball because we wanted the thing to snowball, and the Coventry Telegraph had its Christmas charity. Ian Rufus and I went and sat down with the editor of the Coventry Telegraph for a meal just down the road from where I'm talking now. We said, this is silly, should we combine forces? And we did. For 10 years or so, it was extraordinarily successful, raising money for chronically sick and handicapped children. And I always felt it was a way of us giving something back to a community that had put its hand in its pockets to pay for us to be there through responding to our advertisers. Again, without trying to sound terribly grand about it all, as I've left regular full-time broadcasting with the BBC, or with anybody come to that, I've been appointed to the post of Chair of Health Watch in Coventry, which is a voluntary role. Fascinating. I was told when I was appointed to it, you are now a key player in the health economy, whatever that's supposed to mean, in Coventry. And basically, I'm doing what I've always done on the radio, really, which is challenging authority, asking the questions, ask the awkward questions on behalf of the patient. And so, again, for me, that's a way of putting something back. So hopefully that's how I might be remembered, is somebody who made his mark, contributed, but also put a little bit back.
For more in this series, search Radio Moments Conversations in your podcast player or go to radiomoments.com.